last 20 years, there's been a lot of talk about let's fix it. In Marion County, we had an idea, and Alachua County had an idea. Where does that stand? Is it ever going to get fixed?
Well, I mean, first of all, when we have these drainage features in the bottom of lakes, or, you know, if, for example, the Santa Fe River disappears down a drainage sink, I think we realize that these are very important water features. So I would rather, instead of calling them sinkholes, I call them drainage sinks, because I think it's important to understand that when they serve a purpose of draining water and they're part of a natural system, then they really have a function, as opposed to a sinkhole, which, you know, other than maybe Devil's Millhopper, most times when people mention sinkholes, they get concerned about a house falling in or a road caving in, or a Porsche dealership in Winter Park disappearing. So the point is, I think in terms of Orange Lake, the geology of that lake is such that if you did try to plug them up, the sinks in the bottom of the lake, assuming you thought it was a good idea, most likely what would happen is that there would just be other sinks that would open up other places, because there's just a lot of pressure. And the way that system naturally flows is that actually the southern part of Orange Lake is recharge. They've actually done dye trace studies that suggest that that water is draining back into the aquifer, and it's part of the Silver Springs spring shed. So again, there's just a lot of important relationships, and because of that, at least in my opinion, it would not be wise to start trying to mess with Mother Nature. And it's, you know, that lake, I think the other part of it that we know is that these old lakes like Orange and Lacaloosa, they really depend on fluctuation of water level to maintain their water quality. And the problem with trying to control the water level and kind of creating a bathtub is that you don't get the flushing and you don't get the oxidation of some of the muck and algae and really materials that can cause lake pollution, materials that can reduce oxygen levels, and materials that can really not support healthy fish habitat. So I think, at least from our opinion, it's better to leave the lake alone. And we understand there's some frustration, short-term frustration, when you let Mother Nature just go up and down, because, you know, we do have people that understandably like to fish in the lake and they like to have access. If we did try to control it and really make it a bathtub, then I think we've got bigger problems.
It's hard to fathom that years ago they put school buses and vehicles and all kinds of things down that hole, isn't it?
Well, and we've heard that. I mean, we've heard that, you know, that was, I guess that was a way of getting rid of old school buses back then. It's just that, you know, it's like a lot of other things. We've gotten smarter about things. And I think in this case, it's taken a while, but we understand the relationships and we're better able to connect the dots. And we're more aware of unintended consequences when we do things like put school buses down drainage sinks.
Now, some people have also said that when water was kind of diverted to Payne's Prairie, and that section, that also took water from the lake. And so, you know, what is that true, too, that, you know, water?
Well, it's interesting. It's just like, you know, people referring to the sinkhole in Orange Lake as though it's a bad thing. People refer to diverting water to Payne's Prairie, and actually, that's not hydrologically correct. What happened was that water that naturally drained to Payne's Prairie was diverted when they built Camp's Canal, and water was actually diverted away from the prairie. And we hear this, there's sort of this revisionist history as though water was, that Payne's Prairie diverted water from Orange Lake, when it's actually, the fact is, it's just the opposite.
Now, I guess another factor is many years ago, before there was, we're talking many years ago, before U.S. Highway 301 and 441, there probably was a much bigger lake sheet flow that happened, you know, that didn't keep the lake all stopped up between two highways and so forth. But we'll never go back to those days. That's the reality.
Well, and that's true. I mean, you mentioned 301, and that's clearly an area where, you know, there was basically a dam put up. They had to build the road up to, you know, get 301 high enough that it wouldn't flood. And so when they did that, they clearly pinched off part of what was a much larger connected surface water body. But you're right. I mean, I think, you know, whether you look at, you know, I-75, 441, or 301, you know, we've had these significant road systems, and you could probably even include the railroad that goes down by 301. But, you know, historically, we've had these significant changes to the natural water flow. And, you know, it's probably not realistic to think that we're going to ever remove those, you know, as long as we're using cars and trucks.
It's not quite to the seriousness of like what we're dealing with in the Everglades when they diked and dammed the Lake Okeechobee and then put in all the agricultural lands of sugarcane, and now they're trying to go back and fix the sheet flow of Lake Okeechobee to the Everglades. I don't think our lakes have quite that national and international.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's a smaller scale, but the other thing we are looking more at is, you know, there's evidence that part of that watershed that feeds Orange Lake and Lackalusa, you know, if you look at the land use in the area, we've got a lot of tree farming. We call it silviculture. And UF is doing some studies that indicate that intensive tree farming is actually diverting water that would normally, you know, rainwater would normally seep back into the ground and it would be feeding the lakes and the aquifer. But that there's new evidence that intensive tree farming, even though they don't irrigate the pine trees, but just the density of the trees, it creates so much what we call evapotranspiration that there's a tremendous amount of water lost and in some ways diverted. So instead of the water being able to replenish the lake systems or the aquifer, it's basically going up into the atmosphere. And so there's more work that needs to be done on that, but there's some emerging studies that says that one way to restore some of these watersheds and to actually deal with some of our aquifer recharge problems that affect some of our area lakes, like the ones around Keystone Heights, is to actually pay landowners to not plant the trees so densely, and as a way of increasing the recharge to the lakes and to the aquifer.
Now, since you brought that subject up, there are a lot more blueberry farms around the Cross Creek area, but in Windsor or by Noonan's Lake, there are some huge blueberry acres that they're still using some of the old irrigation methods that just spray water into the air, and people have complained that the ditches are just full of foaming water from water running off those blueberry farms. You know, do you think that there's some problems there with trying to reach growers about the way they're irrigating and using water on those blueberry farms?
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly a concern. I mean, obviously, irrigating crops, especially intensive irrigation, is diverting water. And, you know, what we know is that a lot of those big irrigation wells, a lot of them, they have to drill them all the way down to the Florida aquifer. So they're definitely not helping the springs levels or the, you know, the aquifer levels. But the Lackalusa, Orange, Noonan's Lake chain of lakes, those lakes are mostly affected by surface water. So there's actually, you know, wetlands and swampy areas that are feeding those lakes and what we call surficial groundwater. But there's certainly a concern about the water footprint from intensive agriculture. And there's clearly a lot of room for improvement in terms of the water used, you know, to produce these crops. You know, we see it. I mean, farmers kind of make these business decisions, and if it's not illegal, a lot of times, you know, they'll do what they can accomplish. The way the state's permitting for, you know, consumptive use of water is right now, we're certainly not as stringent as places like California and other places in the country that, you know, have had more of a wake-up call on, you know, what kind of trouble you can get into if you don't keep tabs on the water bank account.
You know, obviously, in your position, you are not the person making those decisions about water use. It's the water management districts, right? I mean, so...
Well, and it's not... actually, what's happened in Florida, I mean, first of all, you're right. The water management districts, they have exclusive authority to allow consumptive use of water. But even within that, the agriculture uses are not subject to the same standards that, like, water utilities. And so, for example, if a municipal water utility gets a permit to pull water out of the ground, they have to measure continuously, you know, how many million gallons a day they're pumping out of the ground. We're still not there yet with agriculture. There's definitely some requirements that other water users are subject to in terms of accountability, in terms of how much water they're actually using, that have not been applied to agriculture yet.
So it's trying to rethink the way we use water.
Yeah, and, you know, it's tricky because, I mean, you mentioned the blueberry farms, and, I think one of the things that we try to look at is, okay, we know, for example, the lands that we've bought for through Alachua County Forever and, you know, for conservation, those lands, I mean, even though that's not necessarily the main reason we bought them, but what we're finding out is that they are tremendously valuable in terms of helping to recharge the aquifer and recharge the lakes. But once you start having these intensive land uses, you know, all of a sudden you've got property that it's diverting water and it's no longer allowing the water to go back where it came from. And so we do look at different land uses. And so, you know, one type of agricultural land use may have a much smaller water footprint than another. But we also know that when we start seeing proposals for big developments to go in where they're proposing to have the typical suburban yard with, you know, St. Augustine grass and an irrigation system and a lawn service for pesticide and fertilizing, you know, you could end up with converting agricultural land to suburban development where you don't necessarily come out ahead with the water use because, you know, you're basically, instead of growing some crop, you're irrigating St. Augustine grass. And, you know, in some cases, that footprint can be just as bad.
Years ago, I did a story on citrus conversion to Southwest Florida and the growers from Orlando who used to spray irrigate over the crop. We're having to learn new things down in South Florida of micro-irrigation, having their own reservoir, where the fields, groves drained into their own reservoir, reused the water, and seemed like they had it more together than that we had up here.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're, you know, and you can see that. I mean, there's been one trend that, I mean, for example, certain dairy farms have moved up to the Suwannee River Valley that because it's hard to do that down in the Everglades agricultural areas now because down there they've had so many problems that they've had to tighten up on some of the best management practices and things like that. So, yeah, I think North Florida, you know, we've had this illusion that we've got, you know, more unlimited resources and water's cheap and water's abundant, and that's not the case. There's still a lot of people that seem like that's what they think.
Well, I appreciate you taking so much time to talk with me about water. Appreciate your point of view, and thank you very much.